you're ready.
I am ready.
Today we're going to discuss Ksuvos. We're going to discuss the collection of the Ketubah, Bismanazeh. We all know that a major part of every single Jewish wedding ceremony is the signing of the Ketubah and the reading of the Ketubah underneath the chuppah. And we know that we paskim like Rabbi Meir that Adam Lishos Isha Filo Sha'achas Bli Ketubah, that a man is not allowed to remain married to a woman even for 1 minute if there is not a Ketubah that has been written and is available for the woman to access. That's why sometimes, one of the things that we do at the Beis Din is that sometimes a couple discovers, maybe they move from one place to another, that they can't find their Ketubah. And technically speaking, they wouldn't be allowed to stay with each other if they didn't have a replacement ksuvah. So they come to the Beis Din, and we arrange for ksuvah de erkasa, which is a replacement ksuvah for an ksuvah that is erkasa, that is lost. And we take care of that for a couple. Sometimes you'll have a ksuvah where it becomes faded over time, and there's a fear and concern that the signatures of the Edom, of the witnesses, are no longer going to be recognizable. That's called ksuba shenitashta. It's a ksuba that is becoming rubbed out in terms of the fading of the signatures of the Edom, and we'll do a special ksuba, which is a replacement ksuba for the ksuba that's about to become completely faded. But you have to do that before it's become faded. Then once it's faded and you can no longer make out the signatures of the Edom, then it's already too late. So we've done that as well. And then there's also ksuba the ishtachak beit usa. It's a ksuba where somebody will discover there's an error, there's a mistake. Maybe the date was written incorrectly, or maybe the names of the chassan or the kal were written incorrectly, and somebody, you know, a lot of people, they put up the ksuba, they mount the ksuba on their wall, so everybody who comes for a Shabbos meal can read the ksuba. So, you know, some people are, you know, more nosy than others, and they'll read the ksuba a little bit too carefully, and they'll say, wait a second, I think there's a mistake here. And they'll discover there's a mistake in the ksuba, and then there's a special form of ksuba d'ishtachak beit usa to replace that ksuba that has a mistake in it. So we take the ksuba very, very seriously. It's a major centerpiece of the Jewish wedding. You know, people sometimes ask me, since we introduced the halakhic prenuptial agreement, that's the agreement that was drafted by Rabbi Mordechai Willig in consultation with many rabbanim, including Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, and Rabbi Avadya Yosef gave him this endorsement to it, to make sure that we prevent aguna situations down the line, because the husband commits himself that in the event that there'll ever be a separation between husband and wife, he'll pay her a certain amount of money every single day in lieu of his marital obligation of support until they're no longer married according to Jewish law, and that provides an incentive in case the marriage breaks down for the husband to give a get rather than to have to pay the monetary amount. And it also obligates both parties to appear before the Beis Din at the request of the other, so Beis Din will have the jurisdiction to adjudicate the case, which is also very important, especially outside of Israel, where there is no automatic jurisdiction that is conferred upon Beis Din, even when dealing with the Jewish community, because we have separation between religion and state. So it has to be stipulated explicitly that the parties agree that they will appear before the Beis Din. The conservative movement actually had such a clause where the parties agreed to submit to the jurisdiction of their conservative Beis Din that they inserted in the Ketubah itself. This was an innovation from about 50 years ago. It was called the Lieberman Clause, and it was opposed by the Orthodox community, number one, because the Ketubah is very sacred, so we don't want to mess with the Ketubah, but number two, because it didn't necessarily subscribe to a halakhically valid mechanism, because the conservative movement couldn't be trusted from an Orthodox point of view to determine matters kedas to kedin according to what the halakha would require. So therefore there was opposition to the Lieberman clause, but the idea of having some sort of a valid halakha prenuptial agreement was one which was already discussed and envisioned by authorities going back many hundreds of years ago. And in fact, if you look in the official form book of the Nakla Shiva, the Nakla Shiva is the official collection of halakhic forms, goes back over 300 years ago, you'll find in addition to the Ketubah document, there's also what we call Tanayim Achronim, that just like when a chassan and kala got engaged, they used to enter into Tanayim, that to be a penalty that the chassan would pay if he would break the engagement, or vice versa. So there was also what we would refer to as Tanayim Achronim, Tanayim that had some type of irrelevance even after the marriage would be concluded. And that form states that in the event that the parties ever have a quarrel or a fight, and that they're not living together, the husband undertakes that he's going to pay a certain amount of rubles, whatever the coinage would be, every single day until the matter would be resolved. Now that form envisioned that the matter would be resolved by them appearing before the Beis Din to make Shalom Bayis, to reconcile the couple with each other, but it obviously is not a tremendous stretch of the imagination to assume that sometimes the Beis Din wouldn't be successful at being able to effectuate reconciliation, and that the amount of money would serve as a potential incentive in the event that the marriage really had irretrievably broken down, for the husband to be motivated to decide to give a get sooner rather than later, so that he wouldn't have to keep on paying this sum of money. So people would sometimes ask the question to us when we promoted this prenuptial agreement, really to help to prevent aguna situations, how can you introduce something which is so negative and something which is envisioning and anticipating divorce, even at the inception of a marriage, at this happiest of moments when Chasson and Kala are coming together and celebrating their wedding and everybody is wishing them to build a bayis neman b'Yisrael, how can you introduce at that moment in time this dark spot on the wedding, this blot that anticipates the possibility of divorce? To which the response always is, why do you think that this is such an anomaly to introduce at a wedding when a major centerpiece of every single Jewish wedding is the ketubah? And what do you think the ketubah does? What do people think that the ketubah is all about? It's read under the ketubah, but most people don't understand the words. What the ketubah really is all about is that it states that in the event of death or divorce, so clearly divorce is anticipated, and death, which is also not a pretty subject, not something which is cheerful and happy, it says that the husband will pay this specified sum of money to the wife, which is 200 zuz if it's a first marriage, and if the woman was married before, then it's 100 zuz. And then there is what we call the tosefes ketsuva. There's the added amount to the ketsuva, which in the standard Ashkenazi ketsuva is 200 zukukim, 200 silver tablets, the zukukim kesef tsarif. It's considered to be pure silver. And for a woman who was married before, it's 100 zukukim. It's 100 talents of pure silver. And these amounts are not the support amounts that a husband pays during the course of the marriage. We have some language in the ksuba about how the husband undertakes that he's going to support and take care of his wife and so forth. But the main essence of the ksuba is this obligation that the husband takes upon himself to pay this sum of money, either himself or from his estate, in the event of death or divorce. And that certainly casts a pall on some level on the festivity of the wedding, but we recognize that it's always important to prepare for the future. So the same way in which we don't consider the ketuba to be a blot on the wedding ceremony, we shouldn't consider it to be a blot on the wedding ceremony to have parties make the necessary preparations to ensure that there's a commitment on the part of the husband that he's not going to make his wife an aguna by entering into the prenuptial agreements. So that's always our explanation. But again, that reaffirms the idea of the ksuba being a relevant document that people do sign at the time of the wedding for some sort of purpose. So what's the purpose? That in the event of death or divorce, this amount will get paid. So I'd like to discuss today is how much does this issue actually get adjudicated by Beis Din? To what degree do we ever really enforce the ketubah, the main essence of what the ketubah is about, where a woman would show up and say, okay, I want to collect my ketubah, whether she's a grusha, she's been divorced, whether she's an almana, she became a widow. How does that work exactly? So let's just look at the basic source just for starters. So the Rambam codifies, yes.
What you mentioned in terms of all the different kinds of replacement ketubahs that people don't know about, do any of those need any ma'aser Beis Din? They just need somebody who knows what they're doing.
They need somebody who knows what they're doing. They need somebody who knows what they're doing, and usually it's the Beis Din. It could be the local Orthodox rabbi who also orchestrates the signing of those documents, but I find that very often people will come to the Beis Din to take care of it. So the Rambam in Hilchos Yishus Perek Yud Halacha Zayin, he codifies Tzarech Liktov Ksuva Konim Knisa L'Chuppah V'Kaki Yemuta V'Ishto, that this is part and parcel of what enables a husband and wife to live together, that there's a ksuva that's entered into at the time of the wedding, the chasan pays for it. Kamu kosep la, what's the amount of the ksuva? The Rambam gives you the standard amounts of ma'isa besula and kosam pachas mesayim dinarim. If the woman is getting married for the first time, she's a besula, so she does not receive less than 200 dinarim. 200 dinarim are equivalent to 50 shekel. There are 4 dinarim in every single shekel, so that's 200 dinarim. Dinarim also have another term that we refer to in Aramaic. What's that term? Zuz. A dinar is equivalent to a zuz, so it's 200 zuz. Then beula, and if she was married before, en kosrin, she's not a besula, en kosrin la pachas mimea dinarim, then she gets 100 dinarim, 100 zuz. And this part, v'zeo anikra ikra kesuva, this is the main part of the kesuva, but then there's an added on part as well. If you could add many, many talents of gold if he wants, but whatever additional amount is added, as I said, our standard added amount is 200 zikukim of kesef tzarev, but whatever amount it is, we call the whole thing together. The ikra kesuva, the main obligatory part of the kesuva that every single husband has to furnish to his wife, and the additional part that the husband obligates himself to pay, together, collectively, we call it ketubah. We don't say, oh, now the Rav is going, we call up Rabbi so-and-so to read the Iker Ksuva and the Tosefis Ksuva. We don't say that. We just say Ksuva. It's one generic term. So we're defining terms right now. The Rabbi was a good lawyer. You know, in every legal document, the beginning of the document is definitions. We're going to define terms. I remember when I started practicing law, so one of the partners in my law firm told us that the most important part of any legal document is the definition section. You explain exactly what it is that you're talking about. Okay, so the Rambam does that, because the Rambam was a good lawyer. Says the Rambam, where did this idea of ksuva come from? Is this something which is in the Torah? So the Rambam says, no, the rabbis made it up. The rabbis established this idea of ksuva, but they did it because they care about women. Kedei shelo tiyeh kala be'einav lotzia, so that a woman would not be treated lightly by her husband, that he would divorce her upon a whim, precipitously and impetuously. Rather, we want him to pause before he decides to divorce his wife, so he knows that in the event that he wants to divorce his wife, he would have to pay this sizable sum of money, and that would serve as a disincentive for a husband to divorce his wife precipitously. Shlote kala, kala with a kuf, not with a kaf. Right? When he marries her, she's a kala with a kaf. However, we don't want her to be kala with a kuf, that she should be kala, that she should be light and insignificant to him, that he would divorce her too quickly. So the Rambam seems to indicate that ksuvah is the Rabbanan. In the Sefer Mitzvah, however, the Rambam seems to indicate that ksuvah is the Raisa. It says the mitzvah shin nun hei, of mitzvah lo sase, of negative mitzvahs, hishi sahi ranu, shelo lavo lisha velo ksuvah velo kidushin. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu admonishes us that we're not allowed to get married unless we provide a ksuva for the wife. That we don't view marriage as some type of an insignificant matter. We view it as something which is formal and official and not trivial in nature, and therefore it requires a ksuva. So which is it according to the Rambam? Is ksuva deraisa or ksuva derabanan? So the Rambam teases us. He makes it seem a little bit unclear as to whether it's a Torah obligation, whether it's a rabbinic obligation, and that's because the Gemara tells us already that it's a machlokus. It genuinely is unclear. So the Rambam will be 100% clear, and there'd be nothing to decipher, analyze within the Rambam, then he wouldn't be the Rambam. So the Rambam had to create something of a confusion and a conundrum for us, so that we would have to think about the issue a little bit more carefully. If you look in the Torah, in Sefer Shmos, Parshas Mishpatim, Torah speaks about a man who seduces a woman who has never been with a man before. She is not to become betrothed to anybody. She is a virgin, and he sleeps with her. He's supposed to marry her. But the terminology that is used is Mahor Yimhareno Lo. She's supposed to receive, the next pasuk says, Kesef Yishkol Kimora Bisulos, that even if he does not marry her, says he's supposed to pay her a certain sum of money. So it sounds like maybe only if he doesn't marry her, he pays her the money. But the previous pasuk says, no, Mahor Yimhareno Lo Lisha. What is Mahor Yimhareno Lo? Does that mean Maher? He better rush and hurry up and marry her? No, it's not English. So there's a Hebrew term, Mahor. What does Mahor mean? We find that in the Islamic community, they speak about Mohar. So Mohar is a reference to some type of a marriage dowry. So this really comes from this biblical term, right? Mahor Yimarena Lo. So Rashi tells us, what is Mahor Yimarena? So Yimarena, okay, what does it mean? Yifsok La Mohar, there's a little chup here, which is really just in reference to some sort of a footnote that comes from the Bar-Ilan Sidi Ram. Yifsok La Mohar Kimishpat Ishli Ishto, that he should provide for her some type of a dowry, like a man provides for a wife. Shikosi laksuva, that a man provides a wife with a ksuva at the time of Bisa'ena when he marries her. So it sounds from Rashi that ksuva is a Torah notion, that this is a Torah document. This is really serious stuff. It's required from the Torah. But the Ramban shoots back at Rashi right away. He says, Umashi piva sharab, this is source hey, right on that spot, Perikop Beis Pasuk Tesvav. Rashi says means ksuva. No, eno emes, that's not right. Because there is no money paid if he marries her. It's the next pasuk says only if he doesn't marry her. Only if this man who seduced the woman doesn't marry her does he have to pay this kesef yishkol, a certain amount of money, which we derive as 50 shekel, like the amount which is paid elsewhere, namely when a man rapes a woman, so he has to pay the 50 shekel. That's a separate pasuk in Devar. And he says, if he divorces her after the nisuin, he doesn't actually have to pay her anything. Who says the Ramban, this idea of the ksuva is not from this pasuk, it's not a Torah law, it's a midivrei sofim, it's a rabbinic law. The ksuva is a rabbinic law, it certainly does not come directly from the Torah. And if you look in the Gemara, that's in the Maseches Ksuvos Daf Yudim and Aleph, we find this is a machlokus between Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel and the Chachamim. They talk about the following case. A man marries a woman in Kaputkia. I don't know where Kaputkia is. It's outside of Israel. He marries a woman in Kaputkia, and then he ends up divorcing the woman in Israel. Now, the coins in Kaputkia are larger and heavier than the coins which are in Israel. So what is the amount of what type of coins does he have to pay her, the wife, when he divorces her in Israel, and he has to pay her the coins to pay off the ksuva? Do they have to be, can they have to be kaputkia coins, which are larger? Or can he say, look, we're getting divorced in Israel, let me pay the ksuva off with the less valuable coins? What does he have to do? So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says he has to pay with kaputkia coins. The Chachamim say it doesn't have to be kaputkia coins. Why is Rabbi Shimon Gamliel so strict that he requires kaputkia coins? So says the Gemara, because Hashemina Leil, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, the ksuva sishim idaraisa. That he holds the ksuva of an isha is something which is required from the Torah. It's not Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, no silam of Moos kaputkia. He has to pay her according to the money of kaputkia. So do we paskin like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, or do we paskin like the Chachamim? It's a machlokis. According to Rabbeinu Tam, we paskin like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Whenever we have Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel in the Mishnah, we say halacha is kemoso, generally speaking. So we paskin like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. According to the Rosh, no, that's not an absolute principle. And since we have Amoraim who disagree about this as well, he says in Rav Nachman, who was like the greatest of Dayanim, paskin that the ksuva is only midrabanan, it's only a rabbinic requirement. So we paskin like the Chachamim, that the ksuva is only required on a rabbinic level. And this becomes a machlokis that is not really resolved among the Rishonim. We have this break, we have this machlokis between, you know, two very eminent poskim among the Rishonim, Rabbeinu Tam on the one hand saying it's the Raisa, the Rosh on the other hand saying it's a Derabanan. So we have to look at exactly how this plays out. So if you take a look at the Ritva says something very interesting. He says that even if you hold like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, there are two different types of coins. Forget about Kaputkia coins and Israel coins. There's, in terms of the basic value of the coins, there's the type of silver which is described in the Torah, which is Kesef Tsuri, which is of a very valuable nature, which is evaluated at a very, very high rate. And then there's what we call Kesef Medina. It's like standard silver, which is only worth about 1/8 of Kesef Tsuri. So this silver, regardless of how big the coins are, this silver that it constitutes the amount of the ksuva, is it supposed to be Kesef Tsuri coins, or is it supposed to be Kesef of Medina coins, it's going to make a difference as to whether it's 1/8 of the value or 8 times of the value. So this is a very, very big deal. So the Ritva says it's not dependent upon whether you hold that the Ksuv is deraisa or derabanan. You can hold like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel and be of the opinion that the Ksuv is deraisa, but what does that mean, that the Ksuv is a deraisa? Says the Ksuv is deraisa just means that there is an idea of Ksuv in the Torah. That since the Torah uses this word mohar, kemohar bisulos, mahor yimaren alo, and you're going to pay a kemohar bisulos, so yaof minam ha-mashim gamliel the yesh b'sula mohar min ha-Torah. We derive from there, since the Torah is talking about a virgin, a bisula, that a bisula is entitled to a kesuva according to the Torah. Yes, there is a Torah obligation of ksuva. But how much is that obligation for? He says, well, ein la kitzva min ha-Torah. But the idea that it be 50 shekel, we find 50 shekel, 200 zuz, in the context of a woman who rapes, a man who rapes a woman. So that's a very specific, confined context. There's no real basis for saying, according to the Torah, that every single time a man and a woman get married, that the man has to pay this amount of money, 200 zuz. So saying that it's supposed to be 50 shekel, that's something the Chachamim came up with. That is only something that the Chachamim came up with. So we have this bifurcation. So some want to say within the Rambam as well, some want to say that's what the Rambam means. When the Rambam says in the Sefer Mitzvos, the Ksuv is min ha-Torah, what the Rambam means is, yes, the idea and notion that when a man marries a woman, there's supposed to be a Ksuv obligation, that's from the Torah. The amount of the Ksuv, that's up to the rabbis. The rabbis made up the amount of the Ksuv. We write in our Ksuv, the Chazi Lichi Mida Araisa. So some say that, no, even if we say that the amount of the ksuva, or the ksuva itself, is only the rabbanon, you could still say the words, the chazi lichi midaraisa, because all that means is that the husband is saying, this 200 zuz that I'm going to pay you, my dear wife, whom I love so much, I love you so much, that even though according to the Torah there's no set amount, and even though according to the Torah really the amount doesn't necessarily have to be in accordance with the highest value of coins, with the most valuable type of coin of Kesef Tsuri, I am obligating myself to pay money, which is, as Abba Mavino said, you know, or did with respect to Ephron, over la socher. I am going to pay the most expensive type of silver coins. I'm going to pay the purest silver coin, the Kesef Tsuri, which is not diluted, which is 100% pure, which is worth 8 times the amount of Kesef Medina. And that's what it means when it says, the Chazi Lichim Daraisa. Just like whenever the Torah speaks about Shkolim, the payment of Shkolim, it's talking about Kesef Tsuri. So a husband obligates himself to pay Kesef Tsuri, that type of Kesef, even if it's not required midaraisa. You can even say the entire institution of ksuva is midarabanan and is rabbinic, and the husband can still obligate himself in kesef tsuri, which is chazi lichi midaraisa. So therefore, there's no contradiction. How do we paskin? Wait, you had a question.
Okay, listen. The ksuva is designed, doesn't work out to give the woman
credit. Correct.
How is it that in Israel, certain husbands would rather be in jail for 7 years, as an example, than under the ketubah?
Well, they don't have to.
Well, they have to.
This way, they get out of. I mean, if they don't want to honor the ketubah, I suppose you could make a calculation that you won't divorce your wife, and this way you won't have to pay the ketubah, right? Because the ketubah is only in the event of divorce. The husband says, okay, I don't want to pay the ketubah. He might have other obligations. He might have to support his wife and pay her mizonos. I mean, that's something that could continue over the course of the marriage. That's one of the goals of the prenuptial agreement, because the prenuptial agreement quantifies the amount of support the husband has to pay during the course of the marriage. The ketubah doesn't quantify the amount of support. It says, Be'ezo, I'll take care of you, but it doesn't say to what degree or to what amount, if you want to enforce the amount. So one of the nice things about the prenuptial agreement is that it quantifies the amount based on a reasonable cost of living. And a husband might sometimes have a claim, oh, I don't have to pay her mizonos if she's working and she's making a living for herself. I'll say that, okay, she's making a living for herself. It's like, you know, see my say yadayak with mizonos sayak. That's, you know, it's whatever you're earning, so you'll, you know, keep that for your mizonos. Or he'll make other arguments as to why she may have forfeited her right to receive mizonos, to receive the sustenance that a husband normally has to pay the wife. So one of the things the prenuptial agreement says is that the husband waives any objection that he might have towards paying this amount, unless a bezdin comes to the conclusion that he definitely doesn't owe this amount of money.
The husband isn't a part of that agreement, the prenuptial agreement.
That's right, so he's agreed to this.
We have to be married 5 years.
So that's why we have a very specific text, so that people won't fool around with the language. If people want to insert clauses that make it less effective, so you know what ends up happening? It becomes less effective. That's why we propose a certain language to make it as effective as possible. We adjudicate cases from time to time where parties have modified something in the prenuptial agreement, and more often than not, it creates problems and confusion. Right. So generally, we recommend that people not modify the prenuptial agreement. Okay, so if you take a look at source Ches on page 2, the Shulchan Aruch gives you the bottom line of the halakha. Kama shir ksuba, how much is the ksuba? The besula kuf kuf. Besula gets 200 zuz, the amana, and amana gets 100. And not only an amana, grusha obviously as well. The Shulchan Aruch assumes that everybody gets ketzif, kesef medina, the least valuable type of coin that's really not worth very much. So says the Ramah. The Ramah says, okay, but let's talk about Ashkenazim. How do we paskin? Well, das yesh poskin, masayim shabasuba mana shel amana, misharim yad bezuzi deraisa. We're in source Ches. So the Ramah says that according to many poskim, the amount is not valued according to kesef medina, but it's valued according to zuzi deraisa, the more valuable, expensive type of coin, or purer type of silver. Bushmone pamiyoter, it's 8 times more than kesef medina. V'lachein nagu likta b'ksuba dechazu lichim deraisa. That's why we write dechazu lichim deraisa, and some just say dechazi lichi stama. Okay. And then he says, what's the minog? The minog is that we break it up. If it's a besula, she gets kesef zuzi, the chazi lichim idaraisa, avalovli amana, the amana doesn't say the chazi lichim idaraisa because she doesn't get paid in kesef zuzi, she gets paid in kesef medina. So it turns out that an amana, a woman is getting married a second time, an amana, grusha, she doesn't get half of the amount of the ksuva that a besula gets, she gets 1/16. She gets 1/16 of the amount, because it starts out as 100 zuz, and even that 100 zuz is valued at a coin which is worth 1/8 or less, which is worth 8 times less, I should say, than the amount of the coins that are utilized for the payment of the ksuva of a besula. So therefore, it's actually 1/16 less, or 16 times less, I should say. Okay, so now, that is, that you deserve to have. The chazi lichi that you deserve to have. It's something that is worthy for you to have. The chazi lichi. So now the chelkas mechokek asks, how are we poskening in terms of whether it's deraisa or derabanan? So he said it's not really entirely clear. It says das rabbeinu tamu d'ksuba deraisa v'akor k'ksav litei ma masayim du es dinare dinar tsuri, that according to rabbeinu tam the 200 zuz have to be kesef tsuri from according to Torah law, right? And then he tells you how much everything is worth. He says, well, we know that the pinyon abein is 5 shkolim. How much is 5 shkolim in terms of zuz? 5 shkolim equals how many zuz? Or dinarim? 20, right. So therefore, the pinyon abein is 20 zuz. How much is the ksuva? 200 zuz. How many more times than pinyon abein would that be? 10 times, right? So he said, okay, so let's start making some calculations over here. The 20 dinar of pidyon abein, okay, it's 20 dinar because there are 4 dinarim in a shekel and it's 5 shkalim. So it comes out to 5 lut, certain type of coin. Nimsa masayim dinar come out to chamishim lut. So they already were trying to translate how the 200 zuz is going to be understood in terms of their own currency. How is it going to be applied in terms of their own currency? So you'd figure we're going to have tshuvas that try to calculate how are we going to translate the 200 zuz into dollars. How are we going to translate the 5 shkolim of pidyon abein into dollars? We have to figure out all this stuff, right? Okay, so, and then he brings the other opinion. He says, the das harosh is the ksuvas derabanan, but despite the fact that ksuvas derabanan, we take upon ourselves that in the case of a besula, she gets paid according to kesef tsuri. Okay, so it doesn't really end up making a difference that much whether you say ksuvas deraisa, ksuvas derabanan, we're still going to give a besula what is chazi lichi midaraisa. Okay, fine. It says the chelkas mechokek source yud. How does that work? It says it works because kol tanai shebemamon kayim. A husband can obligate himself to pay any amount of money that he deems to be appropriate in terms of the payment of the ksuva. So once it becomes kol tanai shebemamon kayim, so this actually has ramifications in terms of how you can perhaps make adjustments in the payment of the ksuva even bizman hazeh. because it's not necessary the case the psula gets 200 zuz. That's kazi lichi midaraisa, because the ksuva is a Torah obligation. It could be a rabbinic obligation. It could be a Torah obligation, but the actual payment is only decided rabbinically. And it's a husband who takes upon himself, particularly if we say ksuva is the rabbanim, takes upon himself that he's going to pay the 200 zuz. If that's the case, says Rav Moshe Feinstein, sometimes even when the woman doesn't deserve 200 zuz, the husband can take upon himself, he's going to pay 200 zuz. He talks about a man who marries a woman, she's not a besula, she's been with other men. She wasn't married before, but she was with other men. Technically, she's not entitled to the 200 zuz. The husband doesn't want to embarrass her under the chuppah. So, as far as everyone knows, she's never been with anyone before. He doesn't want to advertise the fact that she was with other men, so they're going to read under the chuppah that she only gets 100 zuz. So he says, I want to obligate myself to pay 200 zuz. So says Rav Moshe Feinstein, that's perfectly fine. No, you can do that. You can obligate yourself to pay the 200 zuz. I had a case, I know of a case, not that I had the case, I know of a case where there was a woman who converted to Judaism. She's a Gioris. A Gioris gets 100 zuz as well. That's the standard amount, unless she converted less than the age of 3, in which case she gets 200 zuz. But otherwise, a Gioris gets 100 zuz. There was a woman who felt bad about it. She was a Gioris. She was a young woman. She's getting married. She wanted the same 200 zuz as everybody else. So the Rabbi Masada Kedushin said, fine, as long as the ksuba identifies that you're a Gioris, because it has to be identified for yuxin purposes, so that if she became an amana, we would know that she can't marry a Kohen, it's perfectly fine, he said. This Hebrew, I don't know if everyone who passed in this way. This happens to be a chaver of mine who passed in this way. He's a Rosh Hashiva at YU. He's not, you know, a cutly cunning be'agma. He's a tamachokum. I assume he also asked Shiloh about it. But he said that if as long as the husband's willing to obligate himself to pay the 200 zuz, he can obligate himself to pay the 200 zuz. And you could even technically say the chazi lichi midaraisa, because it just means that the husband is obligating himself to pay in the type of coins that correspond to the type of silver coins that are described in the Torah.
Now they can read one amount even though it's not written in
the That's the
amount.
Other way to do That's it. Now the problem around, with yeah. that is sometimes it's written one way yeah. and you tell the person who's reading the ksuva, you know, read it a different way. But you know, when you're standing under the chuppah, yeah. you're reading it, yeah. you don't necessarily remember at the spur right. of the moment to read it the other way. So, you know, that's a little bit risky unless you write a separate ksuva that's not the real ksuva to be read under the chuppah, which I know Senator Rabbanim do that as well.
So what about the text itself? If the woman has been with other men before, do they extract the word besula?
So Moshe Feinstein said that you could even write the word besulta. You could say I'm going to treat you like a besulta. Yeah. Most poskim are not comfortable with that, so they say in such a case write something else. That's right, beulta. No. Some say that's like a little in your face. Yeah. So some say write isisa or kulsa. You know, you're right. She's a kala. Kulsa is very nice. It's a nice term. So often that's the solution that people utilize in that type of a case. Yeah, right. Okay. Now, Igros Mo, turn to the Rav Moshe Feinstein, Chelek Dalet, Siman Sadi Yalp, of Eben Ezer, source Yud Beis.
Does the Besager have an obligation to figure out the terminology? Or only if the Kala or Kossin approach?
Don't ask, don't tell?
Yeah. It's kind of my. Nowadays, there's a lot more issues.
If the woman's not marrying a Kohen, then you don't necessarily have to examine, you know, that closely. But the thing is, though, that the woman in the future, you know, might be eligible to a Kohen in case this husband dies and she becomes an Omana. So then you really do have to write it. So I once asked Rav David Cohn, because they asked Rav David Cohn from Brooklyn. Okay, there were many Rav David Cohn, so I have to identify myself. And Vuh Yabes in Brooklyn, he's a big posek. So people were quoting him saying that when a woman gets married, so she's not marrying a Kohen, so you don't have to worry that she's a Surah. So, you know, do a don't ask, don't tell, you know, kind of thing. So I asked him about that, and he said, no, he never said it. So, you know, if a woman he said if a woman's like a Baal Shuva, you know, that she went through, like, you know, a certain type of lifestyle, so it's appropriate to, you know, ask the questions. You got to, you know, get it right, because you don't want to create a Mecholim for the future. Okay, so Moshe Feinstein was asked the question. Somebody said to him, okay, so we have the ksuva. We make a big deal over the ksuva. We just had a whole discussion about ksuva. We replace ksuvas if they get lost and everything else. So how much is it worth? Presumably, I mean, this is like the centerpiece of, like, you know, the wedding and everything is the ksuva. So if it has to actually be paid, there's a divorce, there's a debt. So tell us how much it is. And Moshe Feinstein said, that's a really good question. That's a really, really good question. And he says, you know, since the coins really are not used anymore, the Zusim, the Sekukim, he said, in name of Bitul, my Bayas, Kimat, Bakol, Olam, and Gamaslan, about Sosavish, who say, Assyrios, Ushanim, Me'ach, Shnas, Tav, Shinei, Chay, Mohemes, Olam, Sashni, after World War II, after the Holocaust, Ashilabadak, Zeros, that through all these terrible things that happened. So he said that we don't have the same coins that we used to discuss, the Lunts and these rubles and the other coins that existed in Europe. We don't have them anymore. He says, Mishtam, Shinrak, Mishtar, Sabdina, Shem, Shem, and Bayad, dollar. We have these dollar coins, dollar bills. There's, nobody knows how to relate that to Zuzim or Zekukim. Well, you do it. Nobody knows. He said, come on, let's be honest. Nobody really knows how much this is. Abba Chachamim Vali or Rabbi Dayanim. The Dayanim don't know how much it is. Shira Tzuva. Kamashu Ainu Bezeklau. Nobody really has even looked into it, to be honest. He came up with Yonin Ginasok. So he says, so how could it be? So what happens every time that people get divorced? Even the Bati didn't adjudicate. They don't adjudicate Tzuvas. What happens? So Moshe Feinstein explains. He says, no. What was the whole idea of the Tzuva? Look at source Yud Aleph. My time at Tzakinu Rabbanik Tzuva. Why did the Chacham establish the amount of the Tzuva? Kadesh shall take Kalabein of Notzi, as we said, right? That it should be a disincentive for the husband to divorce his wife against the will. But can a husband divorce his wife against her will nowadays? No! Not since Rabbeinu Gershom 1,000 years ago. Rabbeinu Gershom established a man's not allowed to divorce his wife against her will. So therefore, it's not Shayach anymore that we need to impose this payment of a ksuba upon a husband as a disincentive to divorce his wife against her will, because he can't divorce his wife against her will anyway. It's not relevant, the amount of the ksuba. Since a husband is not able to divorce his wife against her will, tell the begeish misha tovei get no sin. So if the husband really wants to divorce his wife, he'll say, name your price. Say, name your price. Woman wants her husband to divorce her. She'll say, name your price. And they'll negotiate something. According to whatever they're able to negotiate. What about a namana? There's no negotiation for namana, a widow. So he says, no, don't worry about the widows. Even the widows who are not the mothers of the children, because it's a second marriage, and we're worried that maybe they'll be left out in the cold. Don't worry. Ruba de ruba, he gets savab. There's generally a will. Where there's a will, there's a way. There's a will, and the will will take care of the widow as well. And there's a din in the makusa. You got to leave something for the widow. So she'll get whatever money she's supposed to get, according to the Torah, Shabbat Misratzin, or according to Halakha. Shabbat Misratzin was Kwakam Asa Shalachim. So therefore, for the very few cases where with the ksuba payment of the ksuba calculation, ksuba would ever come up, so the rabbis never really had a chance to figure out how it is tied into the dollar bill. They make some sort of a compromise. So said Moshe, this is the system as it has worked up until I have written this tshuva, but it's not really a perfect system, because we really should know how much the calculation of the tshuva is for our purposes here in America. So he says, therefore, that's why I'm Rav Moshe. That's why I thought it's appropriate I should figure out exactly how much this amount is that should end up getting paid.
So Rabbeinu Gershon, according to the opinion, it says it's a deraisa.
Yeah.
Tshuva's deraisa. The effect of Rabbeinu Gershon's takana not to divorce women against will, that eliminates the inyan deraisa. In other words, Karen Rabbeinu Gershon winds up pushing off, making a deraisa nothing.
Yes, because you could say it seems almost like blasphemous to say such a thing. You could say like this, that even the Torah would say that in those cases when you didn't have the ability to divorce your wife against her will, there was no obligation to pay the ksuva. Like in the case of a woman who married her rapist, okay? We can't envision such a thing. That's the Torah law. Torah says if a man rapes a woman, it's such an embarrassment that nobody's going to be willing to marry her. So the rapist is obligated to marry her unless she doesn't want. She doesn't want, then, you know, we don't force him upon her. But if she wants, then he's obligated to marry her. Let's say he's never allowed to divorce her, okay? He's never, ever allowed to divorce her. So in this case, since he's not allowed to divorce her against her will, so she's never going to receive the kesuva, okay? Because he already has a disincentive, because the Torah says he can't divorce her against her will. All right, against
her
will.
If he dies,
so therefore, if he ends up divorcing her,
but not dying.
So I'm saying this, so she doesn't end up. It's mostly the case for a divorce, because she'll take kalabein and leltsia.
Okay, right.
So therefore, she doesn't end up getting ksuba. We're going to look at that halacha in just a moment. So therefore, it's not really an abrogation of Torah law. It's just saying, even according to the Torah, if there's no ability to divorce the wife against the will, so there's no payment of ksuba. So therefore, it's not an abrogation according to that. So Moshe Feinstein goes into an extensive analysis. He also brings both opinions, whether ksuba is the rice or the rabbana, and turns to the next page, page 3, this would be. And Moshe Feinstein talks about the history of the payment of the Masayim Zuz, and he says, you know what, the 200 Zuz often ended up coming out to a very paltry sum that would not create a disincentive for a husband to divorce his wife against the will. So that's why they instituted the 200 zikukim. He said already hundreds of years earlier, they instituted in Ashkenazic circles that they're going to require 200 zikukim. 200 zikukim were 400 zehuvim, 400 golden tablets of some sort, okay, says Rav Moshe. And he said that sometimes the 200 zuz would be enough, sometimes the 200 zuz wouldn't be enough, depending on the wealth and the standard of living and the value of the coinage in different communities at different points in time. So it wasn't always necessary to have the requirement to pay the 200 zukukim. But in those times when the 200 zuz came out to very little, it really did become necessary. And he tells us, how much is 200 zukukim? We're not going to get into all of the math, okay, of how you come to this amount. But Moshe says it comes out to 100 pounds of silver, okay? He says each zakuk is a half a pound of silver. That's how he evaluates each zakuk. 200 zakukim is 100 pounds of silver. And therefore it comes out that whatever is going to be the value, don't worry, I've already made the calculation. Whatever is going to be the value of 100 pounds of silver, that's how much a woman gets if she's a besula. What if she's an amana? So here, this is actually a tremendous takana for the amanas and the grushas, because they get how much? They get not 200 zakukim of silver, they get 100 zakukim of silver, but those are genuine zakukim. It's not 1/8 of the value. These are real zakukim, so therefore they get, says Rav Moshe, the value of 50 pounds of silver. So they're no longer at a disadvantage that they're getting 16 times less. They're only getting 1/2 less at the end of the day. So they also get the Masayim Zuz. So they don't necessarily also get the Masayim Zuz, because once the Masayim Zukukim are 100 pounds of silver, so the Masayim Zuz, which ends up being a pretty slim amount of money, okay, it ends up, because 100 Zuz is approximately, well, let me say this differently, 20 Zuz, which is the pinyan habein amount. 20 Zuz comes out to 96 grams of silver. We round it. We make it 100 grams of silver. So 200 Zuz is going to be 1,000, okay, grams of, 1,000 grams of silver. 1,000 grams of silver will generally not come out to a tremendous amount, okay? So if you look at the values today, here we go. So the current price of silver is $14.38 per troy ounce. The silver price per gram is 46 cents per gram, okay? So it comes out that, for example, the pinyan habein amount is going to be $46. You take that, you know, that per gram amount, 46 cents per gram, you multiply it by 100. That's going to give you the pinyan habein amount. So pinyan habein right now, it's lower than it's been for a number of years. I'm a Kohen. There was a period of time I was picking up like $100 per pinyan habein. But now it's only like $46 per pinyan habein. It's gone down quite a bit. But how much is 200 zuz going to be according to this calculation? It's going to be 10 times that. So it's going to be $460. It comes out approximately $462.33, you know, exactly, if you do the, you know, exact math. But it comes out to, you know, a pretty small amount. So says Rav Moshe, you look at 100 pounds of silver. 100 pounds of silver is essentially equivalent to 45.5 kilograms. So that comes out, as of today, to approximately $21,000. If you do the calculation based on 100 pounds, it's $20,970. You do it based on the rounding of 45.5 kilograms, it's $21,036. It's approximately $21,000. So the ksuba today, according to Rav Moshe, is worth about $21,000, okay, for a besula. And for a gusha and almana, it's worth about $10,500. If you just be looking at the Masayim Zuz, so the Masayim Zuz will end up being worth only approximately $460. And if you're an almana or a gusha and you're getting 16 times less, it's going to be worth about $28.75. So the ksuba today, the Masayim Zuz, of the Meir Zuz, for a gusha or an almana, you're getting $28.75. Not going to carry them for too long. A couple of pizza pies, maybe, you know, they're not going to get past, you know, lunch.
Not a disincentive.
Right. Exactly. So that would not be a disincentive. So Moshe said, don't even look at the Masayim Zuz nowadays. Look at the Masayim Zukukim Kesef. You look at the Beis Shmuel and source your Dalet. The Beis Shmuel already mentioned this minog in his days. Simon Samach Vav, Sivkot, and Tesvav, and Ebenezer. He quotes in the name of the Bach. The Bach custom, Masha custom, Dinas Polam, Masayim Zukukim, this custom that already arose in Poland, that they wrote the Masayim Zukukim, it was meant to be a be-all and end-all. It's like the Rambam writes. It's all the Ksuva. So the Ksuva now, we mentioned the Masayim Zuz, but at the end of the day, you could just calculate the Masayim Zukukim. Haina Masayim, Marak, whatever that is, etc., etc. Take a look at the three lines later in the middle of the line. Vishir Zehuim Sak Suva Shalava Kol Nechlak Mazet. Everything is included in the Masayim Zukukim. We're not throwing in another $450, you know, over $21,000. It's a, you know, paltry sum at that point in time. It says the Drisha disagrees. The Drisha calls him, no, the Shiach Suva Ein Nechla Besak Zeh. So he says that, of course, the Bach agrees in principle. Yeshom Evadeh Ein Aksuva Beklal. Of course, the 200 Zukukim are Tosefis. It's not included. The 200 Zuz are not included. The Bach is just saying it's a practical matter. The Bach calls it the Minik Bo and Kaku. She called it Aksuva Besak Masayim Zukukim. Once I have such a discrepancy between the Masayim Zukukim and the Masayim Zuz, so in the end, we're just going to look at the 100 pound, whatever it is, and that's the amount that is going to get paid. It's very interesting. What? It still says. It's still suva, it's still called suva. Now, how much? Yeah, the words are still there. The words are still there, but for collection purposes, this is, you know, how it is actually enforced. Those few occasions, according to Ramoshin, almost never comes up anyway. Now, how many prutos are in, let's say, the five shkolim of kesef that we have for the pidyon habein? So, without going into all of the calculations, there's 192 prutos in a zuz, there are four zuzim in a shekel, the five shkolim and pidyon habein. It comes out to 3,840 prutos that are in pidyon habein, okay? That are in the five shkolim. It's 3,840 prutos. So, how much is a pruta nowadays? I just told you the $40, which is 4,000 cents, right? Is worth about $46. So it comes out that a pruta today is only worth 1.2 pennies. Okay? A pruta is only worth 1.2 pennies today. So how much does a man have to, you know, be mekadesh a woman with when you go under the chuppah and they ask the edim, is this wedding band, is this worth a pruta? As long as it's worth 1.2 cents, it's going to be worth a pruta. But how low does a pruta have to go in order for us to still say that that's anything of any value once we're on the subject altogether? So I'm just throwing this in since we're talking about the, you know, valuations of silver. Look at the Sma, source test vav. The Sma Kosh Mishpat, Simon Pei Ches, Siv Katan Beis, addresses this issue. Says the Sma, turn over to page 4. He says, yeah, we can figure out exactly how much, you know, based on the coinage that they had in Europe, of a pruta, is a shminis, of a penik biner, of litvish, whatever that is. So he says that the Efshaloma, look at the second line, middle of the line. The Efshaloma should be a man. Are you a pastor? Can you not a mizol? That, you know, it's kind of interesting that how could this teeny tiny little amount be enough to be Mekadesh, a woman? So he says it could be that in the olden days, a penny could get you very far. I remember, you know, it used to be with a penny you could buy like those little candies, you remember, like the penny candies? The penny candy was like, you know, 15 in a roll or so. Those were good. You know, you get like 15 candies, you get candies for a penny. You can't walk into a store and buy, you know, a candy, you know, a thing for a penny anymore. So he says that it could be that in those days they could buy like significant candies and fruits and whatever else for a pruta. You call him habe peis. You could buy like many bananas for a pruta. Okay, nice a pruta chashuva kimamun. Fizeb is manenu. So he says nowadays that you can't, a pruta doesn't really get you too far, right? To any, I mean, sometimes you go to a store and you buy something. It's only like 2 pennies of change. Then they'll say, don't even bother. You put it, you know, nobody, or let's say that the amount that you give them, so they technically are entitled to another extra 2 pennies, they'll say, forget about it, don't worry about it, because it just doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, they want to adjust, today's for what the
says
value
the SMA,
of the kutubos back
says
then.
The SMA makes that suggestion. I don't think anybody actually does it, but the SMA makes that suggestion. Since you can only buy like almost nothing with a putza, I mean, it didn't have a lot of money, they can do shisha sagi with a putza. Maybe a putza is not good enough for kiddushi shisha anymore, says the SMA. Opinion of maybe like we have to like review, like once we change the putza, we have to change, you know, the calculations for everything. As far as I know, nobody goes along with the SMA, but I would imagine that if the value of the putza, if silver keeps on dropping, and the value of the putza goes below a penny, so we probably say that it has to be, like this is really what the SMA is saying, it has to be some sort of a coinage that you could use to buy something or pay towards something. If it gets below a penny, we would probably round it to a penny and say, we're not going to call the value of a putza something which is even less than a penny. There's a question as to whether it should be a nickel, but certainly it should be at the very least a penny. Now, where did this idea come from that if you can't divorce a woman with, against her will, so then maybe there should be no payment, right? So this is actually found later on in Siman Kuf Ayin Zayin. Let's skip a little bit. The sources, Tes Zayin and Yud Zayin, just there was a machlokis when you were allowed to divorce a woman against her will. Let's say that the husband didn't have the value of the ksuba on him. He had to pay this amount. He had to pay the $21,000. He didn't have the $21,000. So could he still divorce his wife? And that would just be an obligation, a hope upon him that she has a credit on him that whenever he comes into $21,000, he can pay it at that point in time. In the meantime, he can divorce her and go on with his life. So the Rashba says no. The Rashba says if he doesn't have the money, if he didn't have the money, he actually couldn't divorce her altogether. The Shulchan Aruch of the Ramah said no. He could divorce her and then he would just be obligated to pay the money when he would come up with it. But there really was an opinion, namely the Rashba quoted by the Chelkos Mechokek, that if he didn't have the money, then he wasn't even allowed to, you know, engage in the divorce altogether. Okay, let's move a little bit more quickly because we have 10 minutes. Okay, so the source Yudches, Shulchan Aruch, Eben Ezra. So Ramosha seemed to say something radical. He said the ksuba never really comes up because a man can't divorce a woman against her will. So the Ramosha wasn't the first one to come up with this. You know who came up with this before him? The Ramah. And you know who came up with the idea maybe we don't need a ksuba nowadays? It was the Ramah. The Ramah said something that would absolutely blow your mind. Except that most people don't get the Siman Samach Vav and Eben Ezra, so they never come across this Ramah. The Ramah just says, like, you know, in passing, like, you know, you're just sitting and you're like schmoozing around the table and you're reading your chon, you're reading the Ramah, so you're thinking like, you know, what's he going to say? You know, how, you know, shocking, you know, can a Ramah be? But just listen to this, you know? So the Ramah says like this. The Ramah says, Vayayin the Kaman Siman Kuf Ayin Zayin. That's the case of the woman who raped a woman and he ends up marrying her, right? That we say he doesn't have to write a ksuba since he doesn't, the Shulchan Aruch says over there, since he can't divorce her against her will, so therefore he doesn't, Elipikach ain't Sarach Liktov Lo Ksuba. He doesn't have to write a ksuba. That's a Siman Kuf Ayin Zayin. Makun Shem Magashim Rap Matsun Isha ain't Sarach Liktov Ksuba. Im Kain says the Ramah, you know, I got all munching on our crackers, where Im Kain, this man is there, and he doesn't say, you know what? And now we're in Shem Gashi Bar Kochas. Since, you know, Beto Gershon came along and said, you can't divorce a woman against the will. Shalisha Mishim Chayin Remeno Gershon, when she's part of the Kaman Simon Kofi Yates. Hayashu Akum Ksuvas Ksuvas Ksuvas. You know what? You really don't need a Ksuvas so much. You're going to make all. I don't know, make it a big deal. I got to discuss these halachos and Vilkos Ksuvas with you, but, you know, you don't really need it. But in a minute, King, Matt, you know what? The minhag is that people write the ksuba. Go figure, you know, Jews will be Jews. Behem Hashanah, therefore we're not going to change the minhag. Most incredible thing. Most incredible thing. So both of these, so the Beis Shmuel jumps upon this Ramah, and the Beis Shmuel says he's bringing a raya, he's bringing a proof from this case of a man who rapes a woman that we say he doesn't have to write a ksuba because he's not allowed to divorce her. He says that's a din from the Torah. That's a din mi daraisa, that he's not allowed to divorce her against her will. But with us, the fact that a man can't divorce a woman against her will, is that a din d'oraisa or a din d'rabbanan? It's a din d'rabbanan. It's chayim d'rabbeinu gershom. It's like even the zman atamis, the achak kasimas atamis. It says you can't bring a proof from a din d'oraisa to a din d'rabbanan. It's a different story altogether. V'yeshlomer, it's a d'oraisa shiny. So therefore, I'm not interested even in the havamin of the Ramah. Don't even dream of this idea that you would be able to get away without writing the ksuba. So Ramoshe, when he's pushed about this, so he says, when is it that it actually comes up? So he says, it comes up sometimes with a widow, that sometimes you don't have a tzibah that was set aside, a will that was set aside, maybe it's not set aside for enough money according to Torah law. You have it sometimes, he says, l'famim mechokim, this was a source, Yud Gimel, I skipped, l'famim mechokim, gam negerishin, sometimes with gerushin it could come out as well. Kishnisrat says, "Lis garish kishitin laksuva b'din." When the woman says, "You know what? I agree to get divorced. You know what my price is." That she says to her husband, "You want to divorce me? You know what my price? I'll tell you. I'll name you my price. I'm a fluma woman. Okay. I live according to Torah. Lord, you want to divorce me? Pay me my ksuva." And we have cases like this that come into the Bezdin. It comes to the Bezdin, and the woman says, "I want my ksuva. I don't want things decided. I'm not going to negotiate. I'm not going to do things according to secular law. I just want whatever is the value of the ksuva." And then we really have to figure out the value of the ksuva. So we saw Rav Moshe Shita. Does everyone agree with Rav Moshe? So not necessarily does everybody agree with Rav Moshe. Look at Source Kapal. Chazon Ish says that according to his calculation of 200 sukkim, that the 200 sukkim basically are meant to be 60 times the amount of the ksuva and 600 the times, tough resh, 600 times the palm shell pigyon abein. What's the amount of pigyon abein? We already said, strictly speaking, it's 96 grams. So if I take the ksuva and I multiply it by 60, and I take the pigyon abein and I multiply it by 600, what do I end up with? 57,600 grams, which is 57.6 kilograms. So the current value of 57.6 kilograms, the valuation of the ksuva according to the Chazon Ish is $26,630.21. So according to the Chazon Ish, the ksuva today is what, 26,000. But then there's Rav Chaim Nah. Rav Chaim Nah is of the opinion, source Chav Dalet, Shirei Torah. Rav Chaim Nah is notoriously known, or famously known, I don't mean in a pejorative way, as having the smallest shiurim. You know, you want kosher hadasim, according to the most lenient standard, you get Rav Chaim Nah hadasim, okay? Shir Ksur Lefi Minagenu, Vel Masayim, so he gives you the shiurim of everything under the sun, that's why this sefer is called Shirei Torah, and he says, the Shir Ksur, he gives you the Shir Ksur, and he says, oh yeah, there's also Masayim Skukim, you know what, you want to know how much that is? It's 3,846 grams, which is about four times, he evaluates it as about four times the value of the ksuva. 3,846 grams. According to Rav Chaim Nah, what would be the value of the ksuva? The value of the ksuva, even with Masayim Zukukim Kesef, $1,778.12. You can say that according to him, you would add back the Masayim Zuz, because it's not like you're getting such a great deal with the Masayim Zukukim. You'd hold like the Drisha. If you add that back into the equation, the woman still ends up with only $2,238. Doesn't end up with too much money, according to Rav Chaim Nah. So the question comes up. So let's say the parties appear before the Beis Din. What do you do? How does the Beis Din decide? At one point in time, we asked the Shaila of certain eminent poskim, including Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, including Rav Chaim Zimbalist. We wanted to get different opinions, different learned opinions, about what they thought the share of the ksuva should be. So some of them said, well, strictly speaking, we have a principle, Yad Ba'al Ashtar al-Tachtona. Somebody wants to comes up with a shtar, with a contract in their favor, they want to collect, so they only get to collect the minimum amount, you know, so if there's a dispute between different opinions, they get the smallest amount. So it would come out, if you follow Rav Chaim Nah, a woman would today, if she got divorced, she's a pesula, she ends up with $1,800, $2,200. Very, very little. So Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg said, no, it could be though, they're in America. America is the makom of Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein is a post-stake for America. So you have all these different opinions of Chaim Nah, the Chazon Ish, Moshe Feinstein, you follow Moshe Feinstein. So I about to didn't follow Moshe Feinstein, but there's a fourth opinion. And this is the opinion, I was sitting in a Beis Din with Igor Rabbanim a number of years ago, and there was a get case that came in front of us, and we were discussing actually having a collection of the ksuva and evaluating the ksuva. Rav Hershel Kurzweil, who's the Beis Din of Igor Rabbanim, said he had a Kabbalah that the value of the ksuva, and he's not looking, wasn't looking at the Masayim Zukukim, he was looking at the Masayim Zuz, is at the very least the amount of a support, of a minimal amount of support in order to sustain somebody to be able to get by according to whatever the cost of living is for 1 year. And how does he get that from? So that's on the Mishnayos and Peah. So Mishnayos and Peah say that if a person has 200 zuz, so they're able to earn 200 zuz, so then they're above poverty level, and they're not allowed to collect from the tamkoy from the public charity funds. But if they're less than 200 zuz, then they don't have enough to get by for the entire year, they can collect from the public charity funds. So we see 200 zuz is a shear that stands for a base support of living for 1 year. So he said, so where did he get this from, Rabbi Kurzweil? He got it from the previous Beis Din of the Igud Rabbanim in New York, in Brooklyn, Rabbi Yitzchak Libes. Rabbi Yitzchak Libes wrote a sefer called Beis Avi. Look at Source Club Beis. So he wrote in the Beis Avi, he said, it's very difficult to figure out the amount of the ksuva, because sometimes, he says, if you look at the actual calculation of the 200 sukkim, it comes up to a lot of money. So he says, look at the second line towards the end after the Kamei Nemes, the Fima Shikasanu, El Shikesar Ksuba, is really intended to be, according to the Mishnayos and Pei, Sikum Shopanas or Shana Tamima. Really, it should be the amount that can sustain somebody for 1 year. But he said, even that's too much. So he was saying he thought that was too much. What would it be nowadays? So when we calculate the cost of living, like in our prenuptial agreement, we calculated about $54,000, $150 a day or so. So that would be much greater than any of these other sums. So that's consistent with his idea that he thought it would be too much. It's interesting, where else do you find this? So I once mentioned the Shita, and one of the Dayanim in Lakewood said to me that this is so way out there, nobody holds this way. This is like unheard of. This is a Shita that comes out of left field. It's not consistent with what anybody says. So I said, well, the truth of the matter is, there's a Dayan in Eretz Yisrael, said in the Bezen Gadol, says exactly this very same thing. That's source Kof Gimel, Rosh Shlomo Dukhovsky died in Eretz Yisrael, in a psak din that was co-authored by him and Rosh Shlomo Amar and Rezo B'Shalom, Rezo B'Shalom, of course, being a son-in-law of Avraya Yosef, or very eminent poskim. So he writes, just matter of fact, like everyone knows how much ksuva is. Sikam ksuva tosavas ksuva strikli mada. If you ikar ksuva shikavu chazal, that when you're evaluating what the total amount should be, it should be according to what chazal had in mind. What do they have in mind? Sikam hashavu 200 zushu. Sikam shadam zokklo lefarnaso. So memeshik shana, how much a person needs to sustain themselves over the course of a year. Avim yeshal also and inu liyakoli tomin etstaka. That if they have that amount, they're not allowed to collect from staka. Next page. Zel skum also kavu kakam lekar. Because the idea says is that a woman, when she gets divorced, she shouldn't have to go begging for food from door to door. That she should be able to have a minimal amount of sustenance for at least 1 year before she can maybe find another husband. So therefore, he says that he thinks that this is a good idea, but his thinking of it was that if you would look at the astronomical amounts that they write in some of the ksuvas in Eretz Yisrael, that they're based on like the gematrias of the Chassid Gal's names, so he says it comes out to being too much. So he was saying this, that, you know, just confine it to this. Like this, at least at this way, it's not going to be out of hand. So Batei Din, based on the circumstances, will also take the Shita into consideration. You could say, just follow the Moshe across the board, but certainly the idea that he expresses, that, you know, part of the idea of the Ksuva is that you shouldn't just send the woman out on the streets. Now, part of it was intended to be a disincentive, but he says that there's, you have to also, when we speak about the Chazal being Misake in the idea of the Ksuva for the benefit of the woman, you also have to think about not leaving her out in the cold, quite literally. So he says that this should also be a consideration of it being enough of an amount that will be able to sustain her for the course of the year.
You look at the Shana? Do you use the Shana?
The best thing will take that into consideration as well.
This is effectively the smart. He's saying, look at the purchasing power back then. She supported for a year then. How much has to support the year
nowadays? The smart was talking about the purchasing power of a pruta, so let's not get carried away. He wasn't talking about the totality of the ksuba, but I hear what you're saying. So I have had a number of cases where these calculations need to be made, and all of these different shitos and opinions are taken into consideration based on the case in front of us, and based on the equities of the situation, obviously. But what comes up, what Duchovsky decries also, is the idea that a person will collect according to the law of the land, and then say, I collected according to the law of the land, which might entitle the woman to all kinds of things that she wouldn't be entitled to according to strict halakha, and then she'll appear before the beds and say, oh, by the way, I want the ksuva as well. He says that, so he was a little concerned about the double dipping that, might occur. So we had a case recently that was very interesting, where the couple entered into a divorce settlement agreement. The divorce settlement agreement said, this is how much it's going to be paid, this is how much everybody's going to get to end up with, and there's a complete waiver and release on any other claims, that might exist. Right. And then there was a clause at the end that said the husband will agree to give the get and to take care of the get. So then the woman appeared before the Bezdin and said, okay, there's a clause in the agreement that says husband will take care of the get. The get means not only the get, but the payment of the ksuva. I want to collect my ksuva as well. And the husband said, what are you talking about? We already had, a whole settlement agreement, all these releases and what have you. So you shouldn't be entitled to, it doesn't say anywhere in this agreement that you're, that in addition to the get, you're going to also collect the ksuva. Everything was waived. Everything, was forgiven. So we had to really look at, once the claim was registered in the Bezdin, we had to take it very seriously. We had to look into it. We came to the conclusion that since the divorce settlement agreement said very, very clearly that all other claims were waived, that a person who wants to argue otherwise is burdened with Hamosim Echavero Lavaraya. It's the last two sources here in the Shales of Chuvas Arash, but you have to look at the simple meaning of a contract. Nowadays, where people generally do settle their, as Ramosha wrote, it's not generally this claim for the ksuba because people settle their different difference is otherwise, especially since we can't have a get Baal Korcha. So unless it's spelled out very explicitly that the husband is going to continue to pay, you know, the ksuba even after everything else is settled, so the general presumption is that has been waived and it has been settled, so therefore the husband, the Bezdin, did not require payments of the ksuba.
Do you ever tear up
okay,
the ksuba? If there's a, you ever say, give me
yes,
your original.
Yes, yes. One of the
parts,
when a get is given, normally speaking, you ask the woman, do you mocha your ksuba? And generally speaking, she is. But generally speaking, they've settled the monetary differences independent of the ksuba. Yes. Very good.
Yeah, the reason okay, is to avoid her begging, she already has money that she shouldn't be entitled to.
Right, the alimony of support.
Right. I attended a wedding of a year's. Nope, Katrina didn't know that she was a